WJC, Los Altos Hills.
And this is Earl Grey, and this is Plowing a Blazing Furrow, the Bevis Frond Special, on 89.7 KFJC.
We'll be right back.
I think it really all started in terms of your recording for the first Bevis Frond album was when you went out and bought yourself a Porter Studio, one of those four-track cassette decks.
Exactly,
is that right?
Yeah.
So
I'd had a motorbike accident, and 3 years after the accident, I finally got some money, and I bought myself a Porter Studio and a drum kit and a bit of equipment, and went about kind of recording the stuff that I'd always heard in my head and never really been able to do in various bands, because we haven't mentioned the Von Trapp family and Room 13, which were bands I was in the early 80s and stuff. And I always felt that while, again, they were kind of writing all the songs, it wasn't really going how I wanted it to. It didn't ever sound quite how I wanted it. And you know, once I got the Porter Studio and I could play everything myself, I could do it exactly how I wanted it. So, I mean, basically, I'm a massive control freak. And, I just got the studio, kind of started recording stuff, had a load of tracks after a while, and I thought, I'll tell you what would be nice, I'd press it up as an album, and then I'll have my own album. And at the time, I was a second-hand record dealer, and I didn't want to put Mick Solomon as the title because I thought, well, all the second-hand record dealers will know that it's me, and it'll be a bit like, oh, here's my record, I'm really a musician, you know, and I thought, no, that's a bit poncy. So I called it the Bevis Frond because that was the name that I always liked best, and released this album as the Bevis Frond. And, you know, at the time it was a one-off studio home project, you know, that was a vanity project, really, and I had no idea it was going to take off at all. I just thought it would be the only thing I'd ever do, really. But lo and behold, people started listening to it and going, oh, that's good, and when are you doing another one? And I kind of thought, bloody hell, this is good, you know, because I was already 33 when My Asthma came out. So, you know, a bit of a late developer, really.
And you just heard Nick Solomon on KFJC. That was actually Bevis Fron. Sorry about that. And that was the song Splendid Isolation. We heard an interview segment with Nick Solomon talking about his beginnings and Porta Studio stuff. And starting off with the first track of the special and Plowing a Blazing Furrow, Part 1. That was Bevis Fron, Newgate Wind, off of the Miasma album. Both tracks we played off the Miasma album. This is Pete Dixon. I'm joined with Earl Grey, and soon we'll be hearing from Daryl Licht. So right now, Earl Grey.
Thanks, Pete. Yep, so that was we're going chronologically tonight. We're going to work our way through the first, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, oh, I can't even be bothered. We've got 4 hours tonight. We've got 4 hours again next week in the same time slot, 7 to 11pm next Monday night. That will be part two of the show. Lots of music to play from the Bevis Fron albums across the years. So started off from the first album, Miasma, which was released in 1980. It says here on 88, but I thought it came out in 86. So let's split the difference and say 87. Complete home recording project. Nick recording at home on a, I don't know if any of you remember Porta Studios, 4-track cassette deck, and all his own songs, played every instrument, did everything himself, and self-released. So first few albums were all like that. So we're going to move our way through the chronology. Wow, that was difficult. And Daryl Licht has arrived, so he will be joining us probably on the next mic break, unless we can get him hooked up in the next few seconds. So we're going to move on now to the second album, Inner Marshland. And one of the things we talked to Nick about in the interview which we conducted with him a few weeks ago was the fact that, particularly on the earlier albums, he used to like messing around with little snippets of sound effects and things like that that were spliced into the beginning and the end and sometimes the middle of the songs. This one in particular, the track called Once More, has a is sort of bookended, if you will, by a gentleman called Harry H. Corbett, and it's from a TV show back in the, I think, the 1950s called Sooty and Sweep, English children's show. Earl Grey is old enough to remember that stuff, so I remember it very well, and as soon as I heard that track, I recognised the voice, so that was quite amusing. Daryl Licht, good evening, and welcome.
Hello, good evening to you. Sorry, I can't see any levels, so I don't know how I'm doing there.
I'm looking after them for you.
Excellent, thank you very much. Little out of breath, doing the usual Daryl Licht road show. Getting off work, changing my clothes, driving down the highway with my knee at 80 miles an hour. While, well, I won't say anything to incriminate myself, but I'll let you use your imagination. Outstanding work, though, folks, and looking forward to presenting this fine material for you all this evening.
Excellent. Okay, well, we'll pass things back to Nick. He's going to talk to us about his use of sound effects, particularly in the track that's going to come up after that, which is Once More from Inner Marshland. You're listening to Plowing a Blazing Furrow, the Bevis Fron special on KFJC.
I thought that was just funny. That was just me having a laugh, really. It kind of worked. That did. I did that more early on, it seemed to be more, because when I started off, I was making a kind of conscious effort to be a bit psychedelic, and then I kind of found my own voice, I think, and spent a bit less time trying to be something, you know, rather than just doing what I do and going, well, if it's psychedelic, great, and if it isn't, well, it isn't, you know. So I think I was making a bit more of a conscious effort to be kind of a bit psyche back then, and you kind of stick in little bits of, you know, like the Beatles kind of shoved in bits of radio talking at the end of I Am the Walrus and all this kind of stuff, you know. And you always listen to these kind of masterpiece psychedelia, and you've got kind of voices going, oh, he's like dancing like a rabbit, oh, you know, and it goes under the feedback and stuff. So I was kind of making it sound as kind of peculiar as I could, really.
Hello, everyone. I'm sorry if I sound a bit weary, but I've had a very trying day today with those two scamps, Sooty and Sweep. They've been in trouble all day long. Anyway, I put them to bed about half an hour ago. They should be asleep by now. As a matter of fact, I'm just going up to find out. Would you like to come with me? All right, come on then. Down this passage. Now, up the stairs. That's it. Now we'll open the door.
Fallen images like breaking glass appear in the dark and then quickly pass. The night with its fears and solitude, waiting for tomorrow's interlude. Frozen water for another time lies lost in the open like sparkling wine. Take care not to lose your inner glow. Wait till tomorrow and keep your head low. Festival lights cascade in your mind, brainwashed dreams that you're hoping to find. The day with hopes and aspirations, waiting for tomorrow in anticipation.
I'm not afraid to die.
started playing guitar, oh God, when I was about 7 years old. You know, I grew up in the middle of London, and my mum was a music teacher. She was a really good pianist, and she tried to teach me how to play piano when I was a real little boy, and I never really got on with it. I mean, I can play a bit of piano, but I remember hearing rock and roll when I was a little kid, you know, so people like, you know, Johnny and the Hurricanes and Johnny Kidd and the Pirates and all that kind of stuff, and I just wanted to play guitar and rock and roll, really. It just touched me, you know, and I would have been about 5 or 6, you know, and I remember The Shadows came out in about 1960. I started listening to The Shadows, and I really, that's, you know, when I decided, well, I've got to be a guitarist, because Hank Marvin, of course, was my kind of temporary god, you know, and I kind of got a guitar from my dad. He'd split up with my mum, and he'd gone to Germany in the RAF, and he came back one time with a guitar for me as a present, and it was by a firm called Kessler. Kessler it make guitars, but Kessler with an F in it. They also make guitars, but they're not as good as Kessler's. But I got a Kessler guitar when I was about 7, and my mum fixed me up with some guitar lessons, which set me on the kind of path, and the guy showed me how to play. I remember one of the things he really showed me how to play was What I Say by Ray Charles, you know, ding, 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 that, which really impressed me, and I kind of started figuring out how pop songs went, and then all through like the 60s I was really into my music, so I was into the Beatles and the Kinks and the Stones, and then the psychedelic stuff started hitting. So by the time I was about 14 or so, I was kind of quite a, I suppose, not a bad child guitarist, you know, teenage guitarist, and I thought I wanted to get a band together, so I had a friend called Ray at school who played guitar a bit, and he played bass, and then I had we had a guy at my school called Bill O'Brien, who was a phenomenal drummer, and he was about 14, so we asked him to play with us, and we got a little band together, and we were kind of covering Cream and Hendrix and stuff like that. I'm trying to think what we had in our set. I know we did some Cream and some Hendrix and Blue Cheer and all this, and we went out and bought ourselves like amplifiers and stuff down in Edgware Road, so they weren't like Marshalls or anything, they were like these funny ones that you could get from electronic shops, but they were about 30 watt amps, and they were pretty good, and we started kind of playing in little kind of kids' parties, well, not kids, you know, but teenage little parties and little bits and pieces, and that's how it all started. And I remember when I first did it, I was talking to my friend Julian, who used to live opposite me, and I kind of said to him, because he'd gone to a different school, so I said to him, oh, you know, I've got a band together, and he said, oh, what's it called? And I said, well, I'm going to call it The Museum, and he said, oh, no, you want to call it Bevis Frond. I'm like, what? Bevis Frond? And he said, yeah, that's a good name. And I kind of thought, oh, yeah, it is, really. So I called it the Bevis Frond Museum. I kept the museum because I thought, well, you know. And that's really what it was. And we did that for about, I guess it was about a year or so. Difficult to have gigs because we didn't have any transport. So we used to have to take our kind of gear to do our gigs on public transport. So it's a bit difficult. And that lasted about a year, I guess, and then Bill O'Brien, who was way too good for us, really, he teamed up with his cousin, who was a bloke called Gary Granger, who was playing in a band called The Confusion, who were a local band, but they sounded a bit like The Who, and he kind of teamed up with him, and then Gary Granger eventually ended up in a band called Strider, and then became Rod Stewart's guitarist in the 70s.
Hey, just out of curiosity, did the guy who came up with the name Bevis Frond, did he ever actually give any explanation as to what the significance was, or is it just a made-up fantasy name?
No, but it was... Julian was... he was a really clever kid. He was... he actually went on to become a well-known film producer. He's Julian Temple, who did the Rock and Roll Swindle and Absolute Beginners and all that kind of stuff. So I've known Julian since we were about five or six, you know. But we kind of lost contact when we were in our 20s, I guess. But he thought that up. But he was quite an enigmatic character, you know. He'd kind of be walking around St. John's Wood, where we all lived, in his straw hat, you know. So he never really explained it. But in later times, I found out that a bevis is a variety of fern, and a frond is a twig, obviously. So it could be frond twig. Fern twig, sorry.
Yeah.
89.7 FM, KFJC. Plowing a blazing furrow, the Bevis Franz special. All a public service, courtesy of KFJC and the Month of Mayhem. That was Termination Station Gray from the Inner Marshland LP, the second LP of Bevis Franz. Glory on the Waranzo label. And we started the whole set off with absolutely one of my favorite all-time Bevis Franz tracks. Not, of course, that I don't stand fully behind every track we will be selecting over these two Monday nights, but even among them, there's a hierarchy, and Once More is right up at the top of the charts. I'm Derelict.
I'm Earl Grey.
And this is Pete Dixon. You are, of course, listening to Plowing a Blazing Field, the Bevis Franz special. It will be going on till 11 p.m. tonight, and we'll be playing many interview segments that we did with the Nick Solomon, basically Bevis Franz, and playing much of his music. Right now we're going to go on to a song that was I can't get into your scene, and it's right here on the Bevis Franz special on KFJC.
Kind of switching, or maybe not.
I can't get into your scene. No, I can't.
kind of switching gears, but still kind of focusing on little details of early establishment of Bevis Frond and all. Obviously, the vast majority of your releases are on your own Waranzau label, and yeah. I'm just wondering, is there any story behind the name or, you know, anything about Waranzau?
Yeah, Waranzau, I grew up in a part of London called St. John's Wood, which is the same part of London where Abbey Road is. And in fact, my mate, my schoolmate Steve Lehman, lived in the block of flats that's on the right-hand side of Abbey Road on the cover of the album, where they're crossing the zebra crossing from Abbey Road Studios, which is on the left-hand side, and they're crossing the road to the block of flats called Neville Court, where my mate Steve used to live. So, yeah, I lived about a 10-minute walk from there when I was a kid, and when I started the Waranzau label, it was we had a band called the Von Trapp Family, and that was made up of old schoolmates from St. John's Wood. We all came from St. John's Wood, and Waranzau Road is a road in St. John's Wood, and we just thought it was a, you know, there were several, we wanted to call it something that had a kind of sense of where we came from when we did the Von Trapp Family single, and we were looking around for names of roads that sounded, you know, record label like, and Waranzau seemed the best one.
Yeah, you hit the mark as far as I'm concerned.
It could have been Chalbert Records, it could have been Allertson Records, you know, but it was Waranzau.
It's got a nice ring to it. That's still going, isn't it? Waranzau is still...
Yeah, I still put my stuff out on it, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, yeah. Why, the most recent one was certainly on Waranzau. Yep. Nice triple disc.
Yep.
Yeah, you know, I can't stop myself.
Did you send these records to John Peel, for example?
I don't know whether Peel ever played Bevis Frond, but he played the Von Trapp Family. Well, I don't know. I mean, it wasn't, I never really did any self-promotion at all. It was always other people who did it, you know. I did it because it's fun and I enjoy doing it. That's why I did it. I didn't do it to become famous or make money just as well, because neither's happened. And, you know, really, you know, I put the record out. A firm called Funhouse in Margate got hold of an album and thought it was great, and they bought copies and they wholesaled it, and then distributors got hold of it and they hyped it up. And then back in the 80s there were a lot of these fanzines around, like Bucket Full of Brains and Freak Beat and all these, and they went nuts about it. And then American things went nuts about it, and Italian things went, and it was like I was sitting there thinking, well, what the fuck is going on, you know? I've banged my head against a brick wall for like 20 years, and now suddenly I've got people phoning me up from Italy saying, hello Nick, I hope you're fantastic, you know. And I'm thinking, well, I don't know what's going on really, but it's very nice.
I said that was my entree to the Bevis Frond, was Bucket Full of Brains.
Well, right, yeah, exactly. That was one of the first kind of magazines to take a real interest, you know. And yeah, you know, it was great. I was totally overwhelmed by it, and totally unexpected. But you know, once it happened, I thought, well, you know, I'm definitely going to stick my foot in the door here, because it's what I've always wanted to do. And fortunately, you know, my foot's still stuck in the door, you know.
We'll be right back. the charitable trust administered by Baroness Holroyd. All flats have gas lighting, running water, and modern toilet facilities. BR 1887.
About kind of urban living and tower blocks and you know, the kind of the neglect, you know, the philanthropic kind of ideas behind, you know, public housing and how they got kind of, you know, damaged in more recent times where, you know, things weren't maintained. And, you know, because there's nothing, in all honesty, I'm not one of these people who hate tower blocks. I actually think that some of them are kind of rather good, but what's wrong with them is that they were completely neglected, you know, and they weren't looked after or maintained, and the lifts, you know, the elevators broke down, and caretaker lived off site, and they became ghettos, and you're full of kind of sink estates where you put all the kind of lunatics in one estate, and so they were just mismanaged and all these things, and it was a real shame. And a lot of them were horrible, I have to say. They were built on, you know, like the T. Dan Smith stuff up in Newcastle. It was all built, jerry built, you know, Ronan Point that collapsed, in East London and things like that. So the kind of general idea behind public housing, you know, like council housing and subsidised housing for people who had no money and stuff, it, you know, it's a fantastic idea, philanthropic and quite right, you know. And I was kind of really writing about public housing and how it's been mismanaged over the years, really.
That was Nick Solomon, a.k.a. the Bevis Frond, talking a little bit about the inspiration or the meaning, the message of the fabulous track we just heard, High in a Flat. You are tuned to 89.7 FM KFJC. This is Plowing a Blazing Furrow, the Bevis Frond special, a public service of KFJC as part of the Month of Mayhem. High in a Flat, certainly another one of the pinnacle tracks of the Bevis Frond, originally released as a free single with the fanzine Bucketful of Brains. As you may have heard me say in that interview, that was my first entree to the world of Bevis Frond, and after that I quickly was grabbing up all the vinyl I could find, which at that point was only a couple of albums and a compilation album as well. My name is Derelict. I'm going to turn it over here to Pete Dixon for more info.
That's right. We are actually going to be going to Triptych next. The song Into the Cryptic Mix. Go to Earl Grey now.
Before High in a Flat, we heard a couple of tracks from Bevis through the Looking Glass. So we heard The Die Is Cast and started that set out with I Can't Get Into Your Scene. Bevis through the Looking Glass was a sort of compilation, Bevis Frond odds and sods, if you will, that came out after the first two albums. Nick had so much material, sort of wanted to clear the decks a bit before he moved on to the full third album release, which is coming up next, Triptych. So he released, I think it was, was it double? Where's Derelict gone? He knows.
I believe it was a double.
Yeah, so limited edition of 500, double album, personal note included in, handwritten note included in, on each sleeve. Subsequently got re-released, so we have the CD here at the station, which came out in 2005 on Rubric Records. So that was the couple of tracks we heard there, and Nick explaining various things along the way. We conducted two excellent interviews with Nick a couple of weeks ago. Just a thoroughly engaging chap, great fun to talk to, full of interesting stories, and quite the raconteur. And we've also been very fortunate to meet him on a few occasions back in the 90s. So more of that as the show proceeds, but we'll be here until 11 o'clock this evening, and we're running through the albums in chronological order. So as Pete Dixon just mentioned, coming up next is going to be the Triptych album. Before we play the first track of that, we're going to hear another segment of Nick's interview, which we, as I say, conducted a few weeks ago. Broadcasting from Foothill College, this is KFJC, Los Altos Hills. You're listening to Plowing a Blazing Furrow, the Bevis Frond special, and let's pass things over to Mr. Bevis Frond, Nick.
What happens, if I write, you know, I'll write a song, play it back a few times on my guitar, just me on an acoustic, sitting in the living room, playing it through a few times, tweaking with the lyrics, and when I think it's done, then if I think it's any good, I'll just stick it onto... I've got an old cassette machine in the living room, like one of those old boom boxes, you know, on the floor, and it's got always got an old cassette in it, and I can just kind of write, click, play me the song with the acoustic, so it's down. That's if it's any good. And then I kind of, after a little while, I can listen back to the stuff I've recorded and decide whether it still sounds good. And if it still sounds good, then I'll maybe, you know, take it a bit further and do a kind of work up a kind of arrangement with drums and bass and guitar and whatever else it needs and vocals and stuff, which I'll do in my little studio. And basically, if it still sounds good after that, then I'll probably think about either putting it on an album or re-recording it or doing it in the studio, you know, proper studio with different musicians if I think it needs it. But there's no kind of real set pattern after.